From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's still a guessing game where Supreme Court nominee John Roberts stands on abortion. It is clear what his wife thinks. Jane Sullivan Roberts, an accomplished attorney in her own right, is a member of the anti-abortion group Feminists for Life. That has some wondering if Jane speaks for John, and it's put a spotlight on the ideas and goals of Feminists for Life. We're going to shine that light a little brighter this hour. On Point, the anti-abortion group that claims Jane Roberts as a member, Feminists for Life, and its vision of a world without abortion and perhaps without Roe v. Wade. We begin with a closer look at how Washington is gearing up for John Roberts' confirmation hearings. Daniel Kleidman is Washington bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He co-wrote the article Seeking the Real John Roberts in this week's issue. He's on assignment in New York and joins us there now. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the word in Washington? Does John Roberts look like a shoe-in?
Well, you never say a shoe-in when it comes to Senate confirmation hearings, because you never know what surprises might lurk. But based on the public record, based on what we know about John Roberts right now, and what we know about the senators on the Judiciary Committee, it looks like he's sailing along quite well right now and will be confirmed.
You are writing this week that it's not easy to suss out exactly where he stands on any number of important issues. We've heard about that ever since his nomination first came up. Why are people still stymied on that front?
Well, he doesn't have a terribly long paper trail. He wrote a lot of memos when he was a young lawyer, first in the Reagan administration and then later in the first Bush administration. It's somewhat perplexing because when he first comes into government with Ronald Reagan, and you look at some of those memos, he was sort of a young Turk in the those early kind of heady days of the Reagan Revolution, the tone of those memos and indeed the policies and positions that he is advocating are fairly hard line, and he comes across as somewhat hard-edged. And then as he progresses through his career, those edges seem to soften somewhat. That may be a product of maturing. We all, as we get older, we get a little bit less idealistic and sometimes a little less sure of ourselves. But it's also that John Roberts never really became a joiner like some of the sort of true believers. He didn't, although there was controversy over whether he had joined the Federalist Society. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really a part of the sort of conservative legal brotherhood or fraternity in Washington. When he was in private practice, he did not take cases that advanced the conservative agenda. He didn't seek out those kinds of cases. In fact, to the contrary, some cases that he took, the most notable one, that gay rights case, would have worked to advance a very different agenda. So he is somewhat elusive and enigmatic, people are still trying to suss out his true beliefs, and that process will obviously take front and center during his Judiciary Committee hearing beginning on September 6th.
We're going to be looking this hour at the abortion issue in particular from a little bit different angle through the prism of John Roberts' wife, Jane Sullivan Roberts, and her membership in Feminists for Life. But at this point, is there anything clarifying out there about where John Roberts would be likely to stand on Roe v. Wade?
You know, I thought that from the very beginning there was of this process that there was information out there clarifying or at least shedding light on what his position would likely be on Roe versus Wade. I do not believe that John Roberts will be a sure vote against or a vote for overturning Roe versus Wade. In his confirmation hearings for his position on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, he said in no uncertain terms that he believed that Roe versus Wade is settled law.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be very respectful of precedent, and I think it is a rare Supreme Court justice or potential justice who would advocate overturning Roe versus Wade in one fell swoop. That might have happened back in the in the early 80s when he was at the Justice Department advocating that position, or even in the early 90s when he was in the first Bush Justice Department. But that was before a series of cases in which Roe versus Wade was really solidified by the current Supreme Court. And that makes it, I think, much more unlikely that he will be a vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, that doesn't mean that he won't believe or vote for chipping away at Roe over the years in successive cases, but it's not going to happen quickly.
Well, just a matter of weeks now, the TV lights will be on, and we will see and hear what we see and hear. Daniel Kleidman, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Daniel Kleidman, Washington Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from New York. In the 1970s, feminists were on the march. Gloria Steinem launched Ms. Magazine. Title IX was signed into law. And in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld abortion rights in Roe v. Wade. But not all women cheered that ruling, and apparently not all feminists. In 1972, the organization Feminists for Life was born. It rejected and still rejects the idea that feminists must be pro-choice and set out to create a world so supportive of women's needs that they would not turn to abortion. Women, they say, deserve better. Jane Sullivan Roberts, wife of Supreme Court nominee John Roberts, is on board. Skeptics ask if such a world is possible and if real feminism means choice. This hour on Point, Feminists for Life and their vision of a world without abortion. You can join the conversation. Can you be a feminist and anti-abortion? Is this a beautiful ideal or a backdoor attack on women's rights? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is the president of Feminists for Life, Sarin Foster. Ms. Foster, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
So we want to understand first just Jane Roberts' relationship to your organization. There's so much we want to hear this hour about where your group stands, but what is Jane's history with Feminists for Life?
Jane came on board a little over a decade ago as our executive vice president of Feminists for Life, and in that capacity, she served as our board counsel. And since then, she has continued to serve as counsel, although not on our board.
All right. So she's had a strong relationship. She came, I've read, on her own accord to your door, attracted clearly by what Feminists for Life stands for. Sarin Foster, begin to lay that out for us. What's the vision of the world that's at the heart of your work there?
Well, we are proud to continue the tradition of the early American feminists, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, who opposed abortion because of their belief in the rights of all human beings, the same women who fought for the rights of women to vote and the rights of slaves to be free also fought for our right to life. And the early American feminist, in no uncertain terms and without known exception, all opposed abortion. And they worked in an uneasy alliance with the doctors, the early version of the AMA, and the media, and they all got together and opposed abortion, and they believed that there should be legal protection for women as well as for children from abortion. And so we believe that we have a responsibility not only to ourselves but other individuals in this world, and we believe in equality, and we believe that extends to our own children. And Alan Guttmacher and other research organizations have looked into the reasons why women have abortions. And we see that there's a pattern here of lack of practical resources, a lack of emotional support that drives women to abortion. And so for us, we believe that in many ways, abortion is a reflection that we have not met the needs of women in the society. And women deserve better than abortion. The reason why people in this country so often talk about wanting to make abortion rare is because they recognize the fact that this is not good for women. This is not the best we can do. And so we seek progressive solutions to challenge the status quo and say, what can we do better for women in terms of housing, childcare, maternity coverage, all the reasons that drive women to abortion? Mm-hmm. Susan B. Anthony asked our movement to address these root causes that would drive women to abortion. So we're so proud to continue that tradition.
Let me ask you then, do you think that you really could build a society so supportive, so great, that no woman would ever make the choice for abortion? But and if you did your very best and a woman still opted for abortion, would you criminalize that choice?
I think that we're so far away from that right now. I think that there are so many things that we can do together to work on fighting for child care and maternity coverage and all these other problems that we face, that, yes, we may come to the day when we see that a woman who has a loving husband and all the money in the world and can afford all sorts of nannies and has an excellent workplace situation or in the institutions of higher education is accepted for being a woman who and celebrates her maternity. But, you know, maybe we get to that day and we decide that we are going to disagree on the legality of abortion.
Does that mean disagree meaning you would want to see Roe v. Wade struck down at that point?
We believe, well, the early American feminists worked to enact the anti-abortion laws that were struck down by Roe v. Wade. And I think it's also interesting to note that Sarah Weddington argued Roe in part on the basis that a woman could not complete her college education if she were pregnant. So we have to ask the question, why not? Is she suddenly stupid? Can she not read, write, or think? That we've come a long way since the 1970s when we didn't understand what was happening inside a woman's body.
It sounds like a soft answer saying, yes, indeed, ultimately, you would be, you'd like to see Roe v. Wade out. But we'll come back and look at that more closely. Sarah Foster, we're very glad you're with us this hour. Thanks for being here. And stick with us. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about and with the anti-abortion group that counts Jane Roberts as a member, Feminists for Life, about their vision of a world without abortion and perhaps without Roe v. Wade. Sarah Foster, the president, is with us. You can join us. Can a woman be a feminist and anti-abortion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the anti-abortion group that counts Jane Roberts as a member, Feminists for Life, about and with, I should say. You can join the conversation this hour. Can you picture the Feminists for Life world in which no woman would ever want an abortion? And is this a beautiful ideal or a backdoor attack on women's rights? Should it matter to John Roberts' nomination that Jane Roberts belongs to Feminists for Life or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in this hour by Sarah Foster, president of Feminists for Life, and we will hear from a couple more members in just a moment. Sarah, I wanted to ask you if I could to just take us very quickly through some of the main efforts that your group has been involved in. They struck me as interesting. Some you have joined arms with pro-choice groups at some points. What have been some of your initiatives?
Absolutely. We've found a lot of common ground areas that we could work together and not just talk about things in terms of philosophical things, but really work together on the Violence Against Women Act. We worked to fight the child exclusion provisions within welfare reform.
And you did that along with the National Organization of Women and NARAL, the pro-choice group.
Absolutely, CLASP and other groups. And we also work to enhance child support enforcement. Because we both support fathers and honor fathers, but we also recognize that when there are non-custodial parents who are unwilling to support their children, that it contributes to the feminization of poverty as well as a detriment to a child's well-being. And so for both reasons, we supported that initiative. And our primary initiative has been on college campuses to develop housing, daycare, maternity coverage, because we were inspired by a board member, a former board member, who experienced pregnancy while in college and said without housing, daycare, and maternity coverage, it didn't feel like she had much of a free choice, and she miscarried under the stress while she ended up looking for abortion listings in the Yellow Pages. So we recognized that, you know, what Sarah Weddington asked or conveyed during her arguments before the court during Roe v. Wade, that, you know, women cannot complete their college education if they were pregnant. Well, there's a reason why people thought so. And so what we have to do now is to really challenge society and help us rethink the way we treat women who are pregnant and parenting and support them unconditionally. Our goal is bigger than making abortion illegal. We do believe in the legal protection for women as well as for children from abortion, but it's beyond that because, as you said, you know, making it illegal, well, women could still be driven to this. It's really about making those resources available and communicating it to them. And what we've found that on college campuses, where students have said, oh, you can't fight society, you can't change things, that within 2 years, you can do it, and you can develop all sorts of resources when people on both sides of the debate get together and believe that women deserve better than abortion.
So, you picture college campuses on which, instead of whatever abortion goes on now, you would have co-eds, if that word is still used, walking around campus pregnant, having children, keeping them, putting them for adoption. What's the path you see?
Absolutely. We believe that we should focus on the resources that would make those choices possible, the choices of marital parenting, single parenting, and all the many adoptions that are available to birth mothers now that weren't available, 50, 60 years ago. And so if we really think about the fact that there's so many women returning to college who have already had children, their children who have had children while they're in high school, and yet grad students who are married don't feel like they can have children. And this is problematic. We really want to help them at this time in their life, this critical time in their life, envision a better world and understand that they're capable of problem solving there. And so when they go into the workplace, they can sit there and really challenge the status quo by creating small businesses, by working within large Fortune 500 companies to really think about telecommuting options, et cetera. And I think Feminists for Life is really a model employer with women who telecommute from all across the country to work on our magazine. And
you make having a baby sound like a great career choice. Of course, it's complicated, isn't it? Sarah Foster.
It is complicated, but women are up to the challenge, and Americans are.
We've got Sarah Foster with us this hour. She's president of Feminists for Life, the organization, anti-abortion group that Jane Roberts, wife of John Roberts, is also a member of. I want to invite a couple of more voices from the group into our conversation. First, joining us from Washington, Jessica O'Connor Petz. She's a North Carolina native. When she was 22, she got pregnant and made the decision to give the baby up for adoption. She joins us from Washington, where she's there with Sarah Foster. Jessica, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And with me in the studio, Marian Syverson. She lives outside of Bangor, Maine. She's 50 years old, had two abortions as a teenager, says she was using pregnancy as a way to get out of an abusive home. She wants to make abortion as rare as possible. She joins me in the studio this hour. Marian, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Jessica, let me turn to you first, if I may. You've been around the track. I guess it could be said, were lucky. When you found yourself pregnant, you had a very supportive family. Even though your mother had been a feminist, and as I understand it, was not at all opposed to abortion, they were very supportive when you decided to go through with the pregnancy. Do you really think that that kind of supportive environment can be provided for every woman in America? And if it can't, are you still comfortable in wanting to end abortion?
I think it should be provided for every woman in America, and I think it can. I would add quickly that my mother actually was a pro-life feminist. She did read Ms. Magazine to me when I was little and talked to me about issues of equal pay for equal work, but she was certainly pro-life. However, I did feel that I had their unconditional love and support, and so in that respect, you're right, I was fortunate. I think there are things that we as a society can work on and that Feminists for Life is working on to make sure that every woman does have the support that I had, even if she is not fortunate enough to have it from her immediate family and from her friends.
And what if they don't? It's a big country with some pretty deep cracks that people can fall into. We'll look at later at the issue of choice, whether women should have the right, whatever her circumstances. But if someone's in a really bad situation and doesn't have the option of abortion, as a feminist, self-proclaimed, can't you see how she might lose an awful lot of autonomy in that circumstance?
There are cracks that people fall into. There are also so many groups and organizations out there working to fill those cracks. If you look in the abortion alternatives of your Yellow Pages, there are resources available to women. And I guess I would also want to say directly to the woman herself, pregnancy is not a punishment. Pregnancy is not a disease. Motherhood, whether you choose to parent or to place for adoption, is rewarding and empowering. And I believe that women are strong enough to handle this, and I believe that we need to keep working on the resources to support her in that situation.
Marian Cyrison with me here in the studio. We're glad you came in today. You had a couple of abortions yourself as a very young woman. You're 50 now.
Thank you, Tom, for telling everyone in America.
and quite a lovely, unbelievable 50, I must add. Let me ask you, you've been through it. You ended up opposed to abortion. Mm-hmm. There are many groups that you could have joined mm-hmm. that oppose abortion. Why Feminists for Life?
We're making a difference. There is, Tom, my problem was I didn't know who to go to. I was 15 the first time, got pregnant with a plan. I wanted to be adopted. And I thought, because I was the oldest of five kids, how could I leave these poor siblings? If you know people from abusive homes, if you see war-torn countries and see 9-year-old girls holding their little siblings on their hips, we tend to start parenting those children ourselves when there's a lack of authority above us.
Right, so you were in an abusive kind of neglecting home. You wanted out. You saw pregnancy as a way out.
Because I would have somebody who was even more vulnerable than my brothers and sisters, the youngest of whom was 11 years younger than me. So how could I leave this poor kid who could barely walk? But if I were pregnant, I could. So, but who did I go to for resources? I couldn't find anything. I asked people. I didn't say, I don't want to have an abortion, but I just said, you know, what else can I do? I am part of Feminists for Life because we're making a change. We're on college campuses saying, this is what we've got now. Let's pretend you're pregnant here. What happens next? We're trying to make changes in the country. The ideal that we're talking about, let's aim for that. Isn't that what we're all about? Let's aim for that. 5 years ago, did we see women doing the weather in the news with their bellies sticking out pregnant? No, we didn't. But we're doing that now. Pregnancy is okay. Women get pregnant. Let's figure out how to work with that.
And what about a woman who decides that she's looking over the whole range of options and she concludes that for her, abortion is the way to go? What do you say to her legal right to go down that path?
Okay, I say this. When Reagan was president, C. Everett Koop was commissioned to do a report, if you will, on post-abortion trauma syndrome, whatever the heck. And his report, which was just a 2.5-page letter, found, he said, there is no such thing as post-abortion trauma. And the reason why he said that is because when he asked women, most of them, when questioned, denied having had an abortion.
So there may be trauma, but there's still the issue of choice. Would you deny that woman the legal choice?
Nope, I wouldn't. Right now, I don't want to overturn anything until there's other things in place. Mm-hmm. We have had 30 years of abortion being legal. I'm not trying to terrify anybody. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to provide a level playing field, and then let's see what happens, because it might be different then.
Marian Cyrison, Jessica O'Connor-Pitts, and Sarin Foster, president of Feminists for Life, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Olga Vives. She joins us from Washington. She's executive vice president of the National Organization for Women. Olga Vives, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Let me put the simple question to you first. Can a woman be a feminist and anti-abortion?
Well, a woman, the basis of feminism is really giving women options in life. And one of those options is whether or not this woman wants to be a mother. I am struck by the conversation I've been listening for a little bit mm-hmm. about how we can determine, or some people can determine, every situation that a woman is presented with when it comes to an unintended pregnancy. I don't think that we are in any position as women in this country to be able to assess or ascertain what the situation is for that woman. The truth of the matter is that a woman has the right to privacy. It has been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court numerous times.
That is the Roe v. Wade right, the right there that underwrites legal abortion.
And mm-hmm. subsequent mm-hmm. Decisions. And what we're talking about here is the fact that pregnancy is a situation where women are affected by it on a number of levels, emotionally, financially, and physically. And so for us to sit here and promote motherhood as something that women should all be thinking about and avoid ending those unintended pregnancies, I think is a wrong approach, because we're dealing with women's lives and we're dealing with situations that vary from household to household. Mm.
Oh, Olga Vivas, if I may ask, this is being presented by Feminists for Life in a way that's, in some dimensions, sounds remarkably like Hillary Clinton's recent comments saying, and I can't quote her exactly here, but saying we need to be more open-minded about the way we think about abortion, not doctrinaire about it. But at the heart of feminism, as you understand it, and of course I'm sure there's more than one definition, at the heart is the issue of choice itself critical to true feminism, that is, a woman's control over her body, over pregnancy, as a way of being liberated, even liberated from biology.
Yes, I think that's at the core of the issue, and also the fact that do we want government deciding those kinds of issues for us, which is really the bottom line here. It is okay for a woman to decide not to have an abortion, and it is okay for a woman to decide to go ahead with that unintended pregnancy and have those children adopted. It is not okay to have a overall approach to this issue in saying that every woman has to abide by those rules, which is frankly what Feminists for Life and other organizations are advocating. And, you know, frankly, I am for life, too. I am for women's lives. Mm-hmm. There's many cases in which a woman cannot continue with this pregnancy for health reasons, for all kinds of other reasons, and I don't really believe that it is up to us to decide. We want government out of this decision. Mm-hmm. We want women to be able to decide whether or not this is good for them, together with their families and with their, advisors.
Yep. We hear it. Oh, Olga Vivas, if I may, we've got a mountain of callers waiting to join this conversation. I'd like to begin to turn to them. Amy sure. is calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Amy, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Well, I think that I agree with the last two speakers that a lot of the people that have this idea of, that people that get, I'm like, oh, I've been waiting for so long, I'm a little nervous.
It's okay.
That people that decide to have an abortion have this, that there is another choice possible, but which there is, but I had an abortion when I was 18 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I will tell you, there is not a day that goes by that I don't thank God, and yes, God, that this the social worker where I had the abortion helped me have it, because there is no way on earth that I was going to continue the pregnancy and have the baby.
But Amy, what if Feminists for Life were successful and you faced such a nurturing surround of family and government support that there was very little friction, very little resistance to having the baby, lots of support for it? Could you have done it? Would you?
No, I wouldn't have. No, I was. It was just not going to happen. This was just not going to happen. So, you know, I would have preferred, and I'm sorry to say, but I would have preferred to take my own life. I would not have gone through with it.
Can you share with us in brief, if you're willing, Amy, why you were so determined to have this abortion? Was there rape involved, or what made you so determined?
It was sort of a rape. I didn't even know what had gone on.
Right.
And there was just no way, and I just, it was important for me to have that choice. And in any other situation, the supportive and the, you know, all of that, that is great. And, you know,
but for you, it was beside the point here. Our time is short before the break. Amy, we're so glad you called in, and we're grateful for your story. I want to put that before the break to Saren Foster, president of Feminists for Life. Saren, there's Amy saying, there was no way under God's heaven that I was going to have this baby. It just wasn't right for me, no matter what the level of support that had been there. The circumstances were wrong. Are you sympathetic to that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I hear her, and I know that there are so many women out there struggling like she has, and I think that this is about, you know, what does it mean to be a feminist? It just goes back to this idea that there are nonviolent choices, that properly defined feminism is a philosophy that embraces the rights for all human beings without exception, and that means including our own children. And you know, we have responsibilities to ourselves and we have responsibilities to our children. And if we're not prepared to parent, I think that there are so many adoption options that Jessica has spoken eloquently of that we need to really focus on those, because I don't think
there's
that
a judgment
forcing
that
maternity
Amy,
on someone is it.
Right, but Amy was not prepared to accept that judgment. There's a lot more we want to hear. Saren Foster, Jessica O'Connor-Petz, Marian Syverson, and Olga Vives. Stand by. We're going to take a short break here. You can join us. Are these women dreaming that the world could be so perfect? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Coming up later this hour, the shuttle Discovery comes home. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the anti-abortion group that counts Jane Roberts as a member, Feminists for Life. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Are these women dreaming that the world could ever be so perfect that no one would ever want an abortion? Or does it take people with such dreams to move the world forward? And are you hearing your feminism in the views of these feminists? We're at 1-800-423-8255, joined this hour by Saren Foster, president of Feminists for Life, by Jessica O'Connor-Petz and Marian Syverson, two members who are joining us this hour, and from the National Organization for Women, Olga Vives, with a bit of a different view. I want to turn to our callers. Marcy is calling from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Marcy. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. How are you doing?
We're great. What do you think of the conversation of the picture here?
Well, first, I just want to say that I'm a relative of Susan B. Anthony. And I was raised with the philosophy of knowing that feminism is something that you have a choice. That is the core of it. I just want to make that clear. There is a choice in it, but you also need to realize that to be a feminist, you have to be able to know what's right and what's wrong. And the wrong part is, in my opinion, and the way that Susan B. felt, she was very opposed to abortion. And I don't believe that you should kill an innocent child inside your womb. I don't know if I could go through with it, and I don't think I could. I just, that's the way I feel. I don't feel like you can be a feminist and have an abortion at the same time. That's my opinion, but I really don't feel that you can do both.
We've got it there from a descendant of Susan B. Anthony herself, Olga Vives. What about this? At heart, Marcy says she's for choice, but not for the choice of abortion. Is this the fundamental issue in feminism? How do you understand that the debate is kind of fracturing along these lines, that feminists are having this internal debate?
Well, I think it is fundamental because it is about determining which way your life is going to go into. And I respect people that don't want to have an abortion, and I suspect that they shouldn't have one if they don't have one. But those, I cannot speak for everyone. But I really want to talk about the issue of adoption, which is something that has been brought up several times.
Strongly promoted by Feminists for Life.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a very noble promotion of caring for life to be able to adopt children. Let's just realize that in this country, there are many children that are not adoptable because they're children of color. The children that are being adopted today are like Jane Roberts' children, which are white children.
So these are adoptable but not adopted kids.
Right, adoptable kids, not adopted. Also, let's think about this statistics. We can only go by the facts that every day in this country, 12 million children live in poverty. Now, what I like to find out from my conservative friends or from friends that are feminists, how are they promoting the care of these children? Because it's also about giving children a quality of life.
So I will ask them that right now, Olga, but let me ask you first. If they have a sufficient answer to that, does it change your mind? Because I know they're very anti-poverty. They're very pro-support for children.
Yes, but where are the programs? We have been working on economic issues for 40 years to promote the economic status of women. Where are the programs today after 40 years? We made a lot of progress in a lot of areas. And today we're seeing the wages of women going backwards, not forward, due to the policies that are promoted by our present government.
Let us pick that up. That's a key point. Sarah Foster, let me put it to you. This critique says, Olga Vives says, 12 million children in poverty. What is being done to alleviate that? And if it's not being done, does it leave your view as pie in the sky?
Well, I think what Olga needs to understand is that I've worked alongside of other women in NOW and NARAL and other organizations fighting the family cap within welfare reform and child support enhancement provisions following that. And as a daughter of someone who actually was in foster care, I can speak to the fact that there's a real difference between what has happened now and what has happened 60 years ago in terms of adoption. The children who are in foster care, languishing in foster care primarily, are older children whose parents
not
have
adopted.
Not relinquished them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a separate issue. And there's children, you know, I walk around the streets all the time and see people and know friends of mine who have adopted multi-ethnic children. And so it's
just, you know what the numbers are overall. Most of those kids who aren't adopted don't look like Jane and John Roberts' adopted children.
It's not the case anymore. It's the older children who have parents who have not relinquished them for foster care who have fallen through the cracks. That's what happened to my father. He was not relinquished for adoption, and it's harder to place older children. It is not the infants. Infants who are of every ethnic race, are being adopted. So this is not the issue. And I don't believe that the Roberts or other people are sitting there looking at children saying, I only want them if they're blonde, and blue-eyed. I think that's a red herring.
But what
really,
about that poverty sitting out there for 40 years, as Olga Vives says, despite all good intentions, not solved, and women facing that, factoring that into their decisions about childbearing? I see the work that you've attempted to do on that, but if it can't be made perfectly supportive, where does that leave the abortion conversation?
Tom, may I help address that?
Is that Jessica?
This is Marion Syverson.
Oh, Marion. Yes, good.
I own my own business. Yeah. I am part of a national organization of women who own their own businesses. I run a chapter in Bangor, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
We have got a lot of women who are owning their own businesses so that way we can get past the glass ceiling and do our own thing. In England, a year ago, they introduced a law. People who have children, men and women who have children under 12 or who have special needs children, have to allow their employees, those women and men, to telecommute or to have time to come in that is flex time.
It's beautiful, but what about the women who don't find themselves owning a business or with flex time? What about those facing poverty and trying to make decisions about the welfare of their family, looking at that?
Right. Well, we got to keep making progress. We can't just say we can't ever solve this problem. We will always have poor people with us, so forget it. Let's have abortion. We got to try to solve that problem.
Yeah, but we're not saying that. We're not saying that we can't solve the problem. Our work has included trying to find solutions to these problems. What we find ourselves is in a situation where more and more it is more difficult to get our government to support family initiatives. I can tell you that in the last budget that this president presented, there were over 150 programs that were eliminated, programs that were vital to children and to women. And so we're not promoting it in a way that is getting traction. And to say that we could have a woman go through a pregnancy and then give that child up. Look, I have two children. I've had two pregnancies. And for me, it would be just unbelievable to have to go through that pregnancy, have that child inside of me and say, oh, my God, I'm going to give it up for adoption. It is just not a realistic or fair solution. It should be a choice.
It is a different view of the world, and we hear it. I want to get one more caller in here. Paul is calling from Portland, Maine. Hi, Paula, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is about birth control. The whole discussion seems to sidestep this question, and I'm wondering where Feminists for Life especially are on this issue. Clearly, this is a way to prevent many pregnancies.
Right.
But it seems to me that many of the more strict right-to-life groups don't. They also oppose birth control.
Let us pick it up. Our time is short, Paula. Thanks for the call. Sarah Foster, what do you say to that?
Oh, we welcome people in our organization who support contraception, who oppose contraception, who believe that there are health issues and there are certain forms of contraception that are unacceptable.
Such as?
Because of their impact on women. So what we're focusing on are women who have used contraception and have become pregnant anyway, for those who have planned on having children and then they lose a job or a husband and have problems, or those with born children.
What's your position on the morning after pill?
When it works as an abortifacient, and according to the manufacturer, if she's fertile at that time period, it could work as an abortifacient. And in that case, we would oppose it, you know, so that's... You know,
on religious grounds, or on what grounds would you oppose it?
On the grounds of basic humanity, about when a life begins, and non-discrimination, non-violence, and justice for all, those are the basic tenets of feminism.
And Sarah Foster, I have to ask you, our time is so short. Jane Roberts is in the group, John Roberts is up for the Supreme Court. Should that have any part in the Senate consideration of John Roberts, his wife's membership and the views of your group?
Well, I think Senator Kennedy said it best when he said this should not be central to the discussion and that he was not going to make it an issue. I think that there are enough issues that face the real lives of women that I appreciate the fact that your show has brought more attention to the fact that we can do better and women deserve better than abortion.
Olga Vivas, what about Jane Roberts' membership in this group? She's a life partner with John Roberts. Is it relevant or irrelevant to consideration of his nomination?
As far as considering his nomination, I think what's relevant is his views and his judicial philosophy. And I think we should concentrate that. We're working towards building a world where women can make choices, even including the choice of belonging to Feminists for Life and belonging to Now and belonging to whatever organizations they want to participate in. So, no, I don't think it's an issue. It's a concern of ours, but it's not an issue that should be the guiding light of these hearings.
And,
Tom, do I have time to respond very briefly to Olga's comments about adoption?
Yes, Jessica.
Very briefly.
Yeah.
Because, as Olga mentioned earlier, it's difficult for one person to impose on someone else what is right for that person. And I understand that as a mother, Olga must find adoption a hard thing to conceive of. But the fact that it is a realistic option for many women, I know many birth mothers who have gone through this and have made it an empowering, positive experience. That is the reality. And FFL does not promote adoption over parenting. FFL wants women to have both of those options available to them. Mm. And adoption is a realistic option which can be empowering.
Well, there's more than we're going to get sorted out here this morning, but we hear this fascinating range of views put under the feminist umbrella, and we're very grateful to all of you for bringing it to us this hour. Jessica O'Connor-Petz in Washington, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And Marian Syverson with me in the studio here in Boston. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Olga Vives, Executive Vice President at the National Organization for Women. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sarah Foster, President of Feminists for Life. Thank you for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Space Shuttle Discovery comes home. But what is next for NASA? This is On Point. After 14 days in space, the Space Shuttle Discovery returned safely to Earth at 5:11 a.m. Pacific Time today, gliding onto the Mojave Desert at Edwards Air Force Base after bad weather socked in Cape Canaveral. NASA celebrated.
Houston Discovery, wheel stop.
Roger, wheel stop, Discovery, and congratulations on a truly spectacular test flight. Stevie Ray, Suichi, Andy, Vegas, Charlie, Wendy, and Eileen, welcome home, friends.
And thank you. Those are great words to hear. We're happy to be back, and we congratulate the whole team for a job well done.
Discovery's landing marked a successful end to a nail-biting shuttle flight, the first since the Columbia disaster 2.5 years ago. The shuttle lost 4 large pieces of foam during launch, requiring astronauts to perform unplanned repairs in space. continuing problems left the entire fleet of shuttles grounded soon after Discovery's launch. Joining me now to discuss Discovery's return home and the future of the space program is Tracy Watson, NASA correspondent for USA Today. Tracy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So a lot of relief you can hear in their voices at Discovery back on the ground. But there were moments when it was in space that it seemed, and this may be wrong, but it seemed like we had a jalopy out there. Where does this leave the shuttle program, for starters?
Well, this landing is definitely a kind of mixed triumph for NASA. On the one hand, they did fly the shuttle safely again. They did bring home a crew safely. They had a lot of successes on this mission, performed a lot of firsts with new technology, the first repair of the heat shield in space. But on the other hand, the main thing they wanted to fix after the Columbia mission was not fixed, and the future is pretty unclear. It's not clear how long it will take to fix this problem, and there are some voices in Congress and elsewhere saying that if it takes a long time to fix the debris off the fuel tank, maybe the shuttle shouldn't fly again.
Is it possible that what we're seeing here is the last shuttle landing?
It's possible. I think that's pretty unlikely. NASA will work really hard to solve this debris problem as fast as it can. And the President and the Congress both pretty firmly support the shuttle program. Andy Carr, the chief staffer for President Bush, told the head of NASA that he supports the shuttle program, and many members of Congress do too. I think the future of the shuttle program, though, does depend on how long it takes to solve this problem and how expensive it is.
And, of course, the whole thing is supposed to come to an end in 2010. What's the thinking on the ground about why NASA was left in this kind of duct tape repair mode on this flight after all this time to prepare for this flight, after the Columbia disaster?
I think everyone's baffled. I think even the reporters were surprised by the foam debris from the tank, because most of us thought that they had fixed the tank, and certainly all the NASA folks did too. There are signs now, reports emerging about shoddy practices at the plants that produced the tank. There are signs that there were some repairs to this tank, and maybe that led to the problems. They're just starting the investigation now. It's still pretty much a mystery.
And what about the implications for other space programs, for the Hubble Space Telescope, for the International Space Station, of the fact that we have a grounded shuttle fleet at this point?
Well, unless NASA can get the shuttle flying again pretty quickly, the prospects for those other programs you mentioned are a little bit murky and perhaps not so good. The space station can only be built by the space shuttle at this point. No other vehicle is big and brawny enough to haul up the parts of the space station that are still on the ground. So this stretches out completion time of the space station at the very best. The Hubble Space Telescope was supposed to get a repair mission from the shuttle if the first two shuttle flights after the accident went well. And the jury's still out on that. The director of NASA says he won't make a decision until after the next flight, but certainly the first flight was not a really promising indication.
And briefly, Tracy, what about the grocery delivery we saw on this flight? How are those men in space going to be fed without the shuttle?
Well, they'll limp along. The shuttle did bring them a lot of supplies, tons and tons of supplies, and they'll continue to get food and other items on little Russian space pods called Progress vehicles.
In the meantime, the space shuttle fleet grounded. Tracy Watson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tracy Watson, NASA correspondent for USA Today, joining us there from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonas, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Lieber, Matt Odette, and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.